Live from the Fox News Radio Studios in New York City. Fresh off the set of Fox and Friends, it's America's receptive voice, Brian Kilmeade.
Thanks so much for being here, everybody. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. Hope you had a great week. And a lot of you took all last week off. I appreciate that. I didn't. And you, many of you listened to me all last week, and I appreciate that. Britt Hume at the bottom of the hour put in perspective that huge story in the New York Times about how Joe Biden is looked at really by his staffers as getting old rapidly, older than everyone thought. Like we've been saying from day one, we'll talk about that as well as the president gets set to go overseas. So special guest coming up in about 10 minutes, John Odrozik, Five for Fighting, wrote a great song, just went to Ukraine, performed it in that war-torn region, in that war-torn country. And President Zelensky could be listening to it as early as today, but you'll love the video. You can download it on iTunes, and all the money goes to the guys that brought him there, Save Our Allies. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
I am here to sound the alarm about a psychopath killer in the Middle East with infinite resources who poses a threat to his people, to the Americans, and to the planet.
Well, President Biden takes his old show on the road, the big stop, Saudi Arabia. And the problem, he needs them now, but vilified them for years. And it's no longer Obama's Middle East that he's going into. It's Trump's, thanks to the Abraham Accords, which the New York Times seems to have forgotten. And that was a guy who thinks that the prince is a killer. Might be, but it's a guy that we like better than Iran. Joe, are you going to blow this Trump deal up too?
Number two.
Well, the buck never actually stops with him, does it? This is the beauty of Joe Biden and his presidency. It's never his fault. If it's not the Russians, then it's the Republicans or it's whoever.
Piers Morgan, of course. Biden's two-pronged approach to the economy. Blame and deny. We'll discuss both.
Number one.
We joke about the fact that President Biden's getting older, but the fact that even his team is saying, you know, 10 days of consecutive work, yeah. that's just too much for the man.
And that, of course, is in the New York Times story that it's very significant considering it's in the New York Times. Even in the New York Times lets you know that Joe must not go for re-election in a damning report on his aging and his performance, which reaffirms what we've been saying all along since he campaigned from his basement. This guy is not ready. It's not that he's a stutterer. It's nothing. He was never impressive as a senator. He was never impressive as a candidate. It took the perfect storm to get him elected because he didn't have to campaign. We saw all the mistakes he made, and we watched everyone else ignore it. Now nobody's ignoring it because it's impossible to ignore. He doesn't do any interviews, a third as much as Trump, Obama, and Bush did. And now people are saying, well, he only works 5 days a week. They see him lose himself in his thoughts all the time. They notice that his gait, he's barely lifting up his legs. He shuffles. Everyone's concerned he's going to fall like he did off his bike. He didn't over the weekend. So for him to say, I'm going to run again, he'll be 83 years old. He is right now a year and a half older than Ronald Reagan was when he left office. Ronald Reagan left office at 73, and everyone thought he was too old. He was much more vigorous and didn't have two aneurysms like President Biden. And I just think that I'm astounded that I read the New York Times and stunned that it lasted this long. So should he actually stick around, and what would it mean? Dr. Nicole Safra weighed in on first, which he picked up as a doctor from what they were saying about him as a person. Cut one.
We joke about the fact that President Biden's getting older, but the fact that even his team is saying, you know, 10 days of consecutive work, yeah. that's just too much for the man. We make jokes about it, but it's actually not funny. And as Joey's mentioning, you know, there's a job to be done. And we know that peak cognition does happen around age 30, which is why you say president's minimum age to be president, you have to be 35. Peak cognition, peak physical strength. And now here we are with the president who it's clear you don't have to be a treating physician to say that he's struggling a little physically and maybe mentally with his age and the subsequent restrictions with that.
So more than once, he's mentioned Vice President Harris as president. We know he mixes up Ukraine and Iran. A little bit of a difference. He calls Senator Warner John all the time, the old John Warner. He has passed away, sadly. He had to walk back his statements on China and Taiwan. The only thing at stake there was, of course, war. Vladimir Putin must go, which all of a sudden made it a Cold War fight instead of Ukraine against Russia fight. And as I mentioned before, his aides have said they get so nervous because he shuffles. There are wires everywhere just in the nature of his position. David Gergen, who leans more left and right but worked for both presidents, including Ronald Reagan, says that he is 80, meaning David Gergen's 80. He says, I noticed a difference in his own decline, for lack of a better word. And at 80 years old, you shouldn't be president. And the New York Times talks about Biden meeting a new Middle East that he left 6 years ago. Everything he touches that Trump touched, he tries to reverse. And that's what he tried to do as a candidate. But Trump's finest work, arguably, were the Abraham Accords. And now, all of a sudden, Joe Biden's realizing the rookie politician knew more about an area he's supposed to thrive in, and that's international relations. So does he plan on running again? Vice President Harris on Face the Nation, Cut 5.
Listen to President Biden. He intends to run. And if he does, I intend to run with him. So there you go.
Always would love to know what's funny. I don't know why she laughs. It makes no sense. It's just nervous. Also, she's asked on Face the Nation about what's going on at the border and the governor's move to take illegal immigrants and bring them right to the border and send them back to Mexico. And he says, well, he's just making matters worse. How could you not ask if you're Robert Costa filling in for Margaret Brennan on Face the Nation? How could you not say you are in charge of the border? It is busted wide open. How do you feel about that? What do you mean you had a broken system? 3 million people have come here illegally already, and you're in charge of this. And you've gone to the border once for 45 minutes, and it wasn't the border. It was a crossing. And you haven't been back since. A Zoom call with the root problem of this invasion. You want to go to the root problem? It's Venezuela, Cuba. We have Chinese crossing. We have Afghanis crossing. Ukrainians are crossing because it's come one, come all. You know what our answer is? Well, when it comes to immigration, we have to give them a pathway to citizenship. Okay, that'll stop the inflow. Give them citizenship. That was sarcasm. When we come back, John Andrzejczyk joins us. He just went over the Ukraine. Russia and Ukraine battling it out. While the Russians are actually making progress, they have to pause. They're running out of people. They're running out of ammunition. And they're afraid of this war churning like it did Afghanistan amongst the Russian public. But they want to go out of their way not to have a draft. But he went and saw the rubble up close and personal. And he made it part of a video of a song he wrote in tribute to President Zelensky. I can't play the whole thing, but I'll play a lot of it. And just know if you download it, the money goes to save our allies who did more to get our people out of Afghanistan than anybody else. And now they're helping, including getting our reporters out of Ukraine and still helping get our allies out of Ukraine in that war-torn nation. We come back, that story, and then, of course, Britt Hume, and then we end this hour with your calls. This is The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Newsmakers and newsbreakers. Hear it first on The Brian Kilmeade Show. From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to FoxNewsPodcasts.com.
Precise, personal, powerful. It's America's weather team in the palm of your hands. Get Fox weather updates throughout your busy day, every day. Subscribe and listen now at FoxNewsPodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
And that is the voice, and that is the Ukrainian orchestra, and the lead singer and writer of that song, John Andrzejczyk, singer and songwriter. You know him from Fire from Fighting. He bleeds red, white, and blue. Extremely patriotic. Really moved to write a song to take action when we watched the. It's almost coming up on a year. The ridiculous, embarrassing withdrawal of Afghanistan. And that's where he formed a relationship with Save Our Allies. They helped him get into Ukraine to shoot a video of this song, which you haven't heard yet. You have to listen to it. It's awesome. And then picture this. If you download it, you can actually see the video of War Torn Ukraine. And in the middle of it, you see the Ukrainian orchestra. And in the middle of that is a guy playing the piano. And that is our guest. John, welcome. Congratulations on pulling this off. First off, why is this just not a conflict to you? Why is this not? So a lot of people look at the Ukrainian situation and say, "Well, I feel bad for them. It's not my problem." Why do you think it should be our problem? And why is it so personal to you?
I understand that sentiment by folks. Why are we sending all this money? It's not our problem. It's not on our shores. But talking to people much smarter than me, I think they feel if we allow Putin to devour Ukraine, the dynamic doesn't change. It's just the Polish border now he's on after he takes Moldova and the Baltics. And there's a very realistic chance that we're here a year or 2 years from now with our soldiers, our children, on that Polish border, really fighting and dying in World War III. So I think if we don't stop Putin in Ukraine, the world's at an inflection point. Afghanistan, Ukraine. You don't think China's watching? You don't think Taiwan is next on deck?
Absolutely.
So it goes way beyond Ukraine.
But Zelensky inspired you.
How could he not? We offered him a plane ticket, and he said no, not just for him, but his family. He stayed with his wife and children expecting to be murdered. Remember, early in the war, they were Russian mercenaries trying to kill him.
And they were going for Kyiv.
They were going for Kyiv, yeah. I mean, that's where we recorded this, on the outskirts of Kyiv. So, yeah, Zelensky, is he a perfect guy? No. Did he stay? Yes. Is he inspiring the rest of the world to come to the right side of history? Has every G7 leader almost gone there? Yeah, so I do think there's a reason we put Churchill in this video. I think he's a modern-day Churchill that's dragging the world to the right side of history.
Right, and he's trying to say this is more than my fight.
Yes.
There's something about a guy that meets the moment that we don't see enough that inspired me and it certainly inspired you, and that comes out with this song. And then you said, okay, I watched the video. We played it on Fox and Friends. It was great. But then something happened that got you into the Ukraine.
Yes.
And got you with the Ukrainian orchestra. And they got that piano. And then you write the parts for all these pieces in that. I mean, I can't get my head around what you had to do.
There are so many minor miracles that allowed this to happen. And the setting of plane in front of the Maria, the largest cargo plane in the world, the symbol of Ukrainian independence that Putin destroyed intentionally at the beginning of the year to gut them, to put the orchestra and me in front of that plane on that hallowed ground. Again, it was incredibly moving, but I think it's symbolic of the Ukrainian fortitude and stoicism. You see in the faces of that orchestra the whole Ukrainian people, and you understand why they're standing up to this Putin tyrant.
Right. Nobody wants to be Russian. They're looking west. They want to
right.
be east.
Right.
Russians don't even want to be Russian.
Right.
So John, and they're up for freedom. They want to have their imperfect freedom, just like ours is imperfect, but we have our own. We'd like to write our own book, if that's okay. So, John, you get there because of Save Our Allies.
Yes.
And you don't want to give details how you got there.
Right.
But you were content to do this in Krakow.
We flew to Krakow. We took a quick, it's a military operation, so it's always fluid. So whatever you think is going to happen is not going to happen. We were supposed to have a safe house in Krakow, but no, we land, you're gone, 3 hours to the border. They drop us at the border. We walk across the border. Basically, we're stranded. We don't have a car. We finally get a car. We get to Lviv. We chase a train. We run on a train. We literally, it was like a bad movie. We jump on the train. 9 hours later, we're in Kyiv. We thought we'd be shooting in a—
What do you mean, we?
Me, Save Our Allies, Nick Palmisano, who was the lead kind of producer, as well as one of the heroes of Afghanistan. Hollywood Heard led an American production crew. And then we had some security support. There was about 10 of us there. We had some Polish translators, Ukrainian translators. So it was a group of us. And but then when we found out we could shoot at the Andropov Airport in front of the Maria, it all went to another level, and I still can't believe it happened, but I'm so grateful.
So, John, you said, hey, they go, how would you like to play the Ukrainian orchestra? And you said, all right, they have an orchestra?
Well, I wanted to do this in Poland because Poland has been so good, taking all the refugees.
Huge.
And frankly, they're getting a little tired. They need a shot in the arm. So I was going to do this in Poland, but when they called and said, do you want to do with this Ukrainian orchestra? I said the exact same thing you did. Do they exist? And they didn't in the form they used to. They were scattered all over the country. But President Zelensky personally approved this, and I think he understood what we were trying to do. So we gathered everybody. We had 4 hours to record it in the studio. We had 4 hours to film it. But you said something very important. You said the Russians don't even like this. And this is what this is all about, Brian. It's a salvo in the cultural war in this conflict. The Russians are politically isolated. They're culturally isolated. They're politically isolated. They're economically isolated. We need to show them that the artists of the world are against them. The World Cup's going to be a big deal.
They're out.
And they, you know, they're being told that they're the heroes. The Russian people are being told they're the heroes. But if we have a Live Aid type global concert with every huge artist singing at the end of October, that will get into Russia. And they will see that the world, the artists, their favorite artists are against them. And they can topple this dude.
So what changed? As much as you will move to get there, to make the effort to be there. But when you play the song and you listen to it back, it's very moving.
Thank you.
But what is it like sitting there with a piano in the middle of the street, surrounded by this orchestra, and knowing what you're playing for?
The clarifying moment, we were recording the orchestra in front of the plane, and I saw out of the corner of my eye an entourage coming in military garb. Turned out it was the general who approved us shooting at this location with Zelensky's permission. And he asked to hear the song. And I saw the orchestra kind of stiffen. And when we started playing, they took flight. They played with such vigor and pride. And halfway through the song, the generals and his entourage took out their phones and they started taping it.
Meanwhile, it's in English.
They don't understand the words. It shows the power of music. Everybody's crying. The general's crying. After we played, I lost it. Halfway through the song, I just lost it. I stopped playing and I just watched. But after we played, there was this silence, this heavy silence, and it hit me right away why we're there. These people are fighting for their survival. And with music, our common humanity, their fortitude, it was incredibly inspiring to me. And I understand why Save Our Allies do these missions. I understand why heroes in our history go to Normandy, you know, bring the wall down. It's kind of that American spirit to support people whose freedom is under attack.
Right.
And it made sense. It made sense that moment why we were there.
Don't you also believe that we need a recalibration in things we take for granted? We have an ability to go do all these things and protest and go at it and wonder where the line is. These people are fighting for their utter survival. And in your video are a bunch of pictures of people who have lost their lives prior to this since the unwarranted invasion by Russia to try to teach a lesson because they wanted to vote for their own leader.
You're so right. You know, people say, were you scared? Of course I was scared. But you know what? I got to leave. They don't. They're under this oppression. Putin's trying to reconstitute the Soviet Union. All these things we squabble about here seem so trivial when you go to a country like that and understand people are dying for freedoms that we take for granted every day.
Well, can one man save the world? If you want to do something good today and support Save Our Allies and be motivated by a song that will change or enhance your impression of this conflict, download this song right now, Can One Man Save the World? And all the money goes to Save Our Allies.
Videos on YouTube, Twitter, tweet it, share it. One man can't save the world alone. We're all in this together. So please share this. Play it for your friends. The world needs to see it.
Fire for Fighting's John Ondrasik. Thanks so much, John. Great to see you in person again.
Brian, you're awesome, my man.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. In these ever-changing times, you can rely on Fox News for hourly updates for the very latest news and information on your time. Listen and download now at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Hey, it's Will Cain, co-host of Fox and Friends Weekend. Join me as I share my thoughts on a wide range of topics, from sports and pop culture to politics and business.
The Will Cain Podcast. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com. A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
We joke about the fact that President Biden's getting older, but the fact that even his team is saying, 10 days of consecutive work, that's just... That's just too much for the man. But we make jokes about it, but it's actually not funny. And as Joey's mentioning, you know, there's a job to be done. And we know that peak cognition does happen around age 30, which is why you have, you say presidents, a minimum age to be president, you have to be 35. Peak cognition, peak physical strength. And now here we are with a president who, it's clear, you don't have to be a treating physician to say that he's struggling a little physically and maybe mentally with his age and the subsequent restrictions with that.
And that was Dr. Sapphire just reading the story that we read using a medical background to say President Biden, not the same guy. I mean, we rejected him when he was at his prime, and he's a terrible campaigner. The worlds came together and a pandemic hit, and he was able to campaign from his basement sporadically and erratically. And now people are realizing, to the tune of the New York Times specifically, that he slurs his words, he contradicts himself, he gets himself in trouble, he's declining physically, he shuffles, they're afraid he's going to trip over wires, loses his train of thought, can only work 5 days a week, and can't do anything at night. I'm sorry, the presidency demands more. And Britt Hume has been saying it from day one. He's Fox News' senior political analyst. Britt, welcome back.
Thank you, Brian. Nice to talk to you.
Britt, it's almost as if they looked at a few of your editorials and a few of your rants,
comments.
Your comments, and said
rants.
I mean, you do get mad sometimes.
Well, I do.
So your commentaries. What was your thought that the New York Times wrote it so specifically?
Well, I think it's become so blatantly obvious, and it's so obviously recognized by so many people, as the New York Times poll published today illustrates, that it was just, you know, there's no getting around it anymore. And of course, this occurs in the circumstance of a midterm election in which the Democrats are forecast to lose one House of Congress at least, and possibly by a very great margin, and maybe both houses, which would further cripple a presidency already crippled by the fact that the president himself is not in a good place.
But when you look at this, first off, 64% of Democrats don't want him to run again. What I found most striking is 60% of those 65 and up don't want him to run again. And I saw David Gergen said something similar to you. David Gergen, who served a Republican and Democratic presidents, tends to lean left. I watch him on CNN all the time. He says, He goes, I'm not the same guy. I can't run anything now. And he's 80, and he seems on top of his game. He says, this guy, you should not be president at 80 years old.
Well, in Biden's case, of course, this was all out there and visible as far back as the campaign. And, you know, all the hiding of him during the using the pandemic as an excuse. And, you know, people say, well, he couldn't possibly have gotten 81 million votes. I agree with that. He didn't. Donald Trump got him those votes. Donald Trump motivated Republicans in a way that was beneficial to the party, no doubt about that. He brought in new voters, and particularly on key issues, immigration, trade, and so on. But he motivated Democrats even more, and that's why we have Joe Biden as president.
So he has had 38 interviews. Trump had 116, Obama 198, Bush 71. He's only had 16 press conferences in almost 2 years. So they're holding him back, obviously for a reason.
Well, it's clear. I mean, look, the other issue here, Brian, is, and you know, people are kind of tiptoeing around this, Biden was not too sharp to begin with. I mean, we're not talking here about somebody who was really
– yeah.
You know, it was really the sharpest knife in the drawer, and just over the passage of time or even suddenly he kind of lost his way. Biden was no rocket scientist to start with. You know, I wrote a piece about him going back to the late 1980s, a fairly long piece. And, you know, at the time when he was a senator, he was a bit of a laughingstock because he could clear the Senate gallery of reporters faster than anybody, with the possible exception of Connecticut Senator Lowell Weicker. When I was going to write the piece, I asked to see him, and he didn't want to see me at first because he claimed I never covered him. Well, there was a reason for that, Brian. I didn't cover him because if there was a debate and he was involved in it, somebody else almost always said what he was saying better and shorter. And when I went, so we had a cup of coffee in the Senate dining room, and in which he was going to sort of interview me about why I wanted to see him and to decide whether he would actually do an interview. And he said, "You don't cover me. Why is that? Have you got something against me?" And I said, "No." She said, "Well, why is it?" I said, "Senator, I think you're a windbag."
Wow.
And but to Biden's credit, and this is why people have always liked him, he broke out laughing. He said, "Well, you're not the only one who thinks that." And he went ahead and we did the interview. We got along fine. But at the time, I mean, it was widely known that Biden, you know, would talk forever and never really say very much. And, you know, he was a likable guy and he had a lot of experience because he'd been there forever. He hadn't at the time, but by the time he became vice president, he certainly had. But he was simply not a person back in his Senate days who anybody really thought was presidential timber. And yet, by a confluence of circumstances, he became the president. And that was because I think, you know, Trump was uniquely able to motivate Democratic voters, and Biden was the last man standing, and now we have him as president, and a big majority wish we didn't.
And it's worth saying that Trump did get more Republican votes than anybody else in history, 74 million, but it was not enough to win. So on the other side, some intrigue. Because you have a lot of competent candidates with a lot of talent. I mean, Senator Tom Cotton, Governor Ron DeSantis, Nikki Haley, Kristi Noem, Mike Pompeo. You don't know who else is going to come from the last class. You probably Senator Ted Cruz, maybe Marco Rubio. So there's a lot of talent. Even if Governor Youngkin, I just spent a day with him, could not be more impressed with. I think he's in it for the right reasons to give back. Of course, he's got to have ego and he's got to have confidence. I get it, but I think he's got a great skill set. Regardless, a lot of intrigue. And listen to it.
Yeah, that's right. And look, there's a big question that hangs over this whole 2024 campaign, and that is, what is Trump going to do? We're now at a stage where the public is showing its disappointment with these elderly politicians. Biden is unpopular in part for that reason. You saw all over the poll that you see in the New York Times today. Nancy Pelosi is ancient. And, you know, Kamala Harris is thought young enough but not smart enough. The list goes on. And there's a sense that people want to move on to a new generation. Trump is pretty old himself. He'd be almost as old as Biden was in 2020.
Yeah, he's 4 years younger.
And so the question becomes, will people want to move on? And if with this young crop of Republican candidates that you mentioned, which is a fairly impressive group, many of them look like, you know, they could be president. What will happen if Trump announces? And the buzz is that he's going to do it and he's going to announce soon. And when that happens, will that simply freeze the field and keep these people from moving forward with their candidacy? Will somebody take him on? If somebody takes him on and is able to beat him, which is, I think, possible, will the Trump voters that turned out in such numbers in 2016 and again in 2020, will they vote for somebody beside him? And would they ever vote for somebody who beat him? That's a big question, Brian.
They're great questions. And I thought Governor Chris Christie said something, who more than likely would run if Trump runs. Here's what he said about what's different this time. Cut eight.
And that's in primary. Like that was a general election phenomenon in 2016. No one wanted to say they were voting for Trump over Hillary to a pollster. Now in Republican primary polling, it is politically incorrect to say you're against Trump.
So he said, if you say you're against Trump and you want to run, it'll kill you. Like Governor Hogan of Maryland's never going to get a shot. He's just an anti-Trumper. But can you run being Governor Youngkin? Yeah, well, I always like President Trump. Did something's good. I think I could be a better candidate. Because if you just alienate the Trump voters, you'll end up like Liz Cheney.
Well, that's a concern. I mean, that's the worry. And, you know, my own sense is that the Republicans cannot win in 2024 with Trump. But they can't win. They may also not be able to win without his supporters. So how do you finesse that? I mean, Glenn Youngkin, as you just mentioned, did so to some extent in his race for governor in Virginia he never criticized Trump, but he kept his distance from Trump. But if the guy's in the race and on the primary ballots, you got to deal with him. And the other thing is, this could affect 2022, Brian, because if Trump comes out sometime in the near future and announces his campaign, every Republican candidate in the country is going to be asked what is his position on Trump. And, you know, are you for him or are you against him? And what is the consequence of – and it's, I don't know how you finesse that.
You know, I almost think
say, he's not on this ballot. I'm not going to comment on that. We're going to wait and see. I don't think that'll work. I think you're going to have to face it.
I think regardless, if Trump says he for some reason he's not going to run, let's say the AG interrogation and ridiculous lawsuits that are taking place here in New York end up being debilitating. Let's say something happens in Georgia that gives him in legal trouble, or something happens from something happened with Merrick Garland bringing charges against him. I feel like he's going to get out and in two or three times. I think that'll be part of the drama. And if he, so I think I could see that being an issue. You?
Well, I think, look, it's an interesting phenomenon with this January 6th committee that they are, you know, every time you look at something that they're excited about, it is always the further demolition of Donald Trump's image and reputation. That is what they're doing. And the question then arises is if they're successful in doing that and it keeps Trump off the stage, I'm not sure that it can, but if it did, would it help the Republicans more than it would help the Democrats?
Great point.
I think there's a very good chance it could help the Republicans more.
I like what some – yeah, go ahead.
Well, I'm just thinking the record the Democrats have made so far under Biden – is about as much trouble as I've ever seen a party stir up for itself, and at least of all in such a short period of time. It's amazing what's happened. So, but if Trump is in the middle of things and is still motivating Democrats, and the more, you know, the more damage is done to his reputation, the more Democrats will fear him and come out to oppose him. I think it's the key question, and maybe even for 2022.
I know what I love when someone as experienced as you are is also intrigued by this. So much of this is unprecedented. And I want to bring it to the other issue, what I think is a huge problem. And I think it's these protests. And when I saw Justice Kavanaugh got forced out of Morton's, had to leave out the back door, Morton's comes out saying these protests are out of control. And now they're starting to harass Morton's Steakhouse and starting to call in phony reservations and continue the protests around establishments, which means – how many people, if you're Justice Kavanaugh or Justice Thomas or Alito, do you, Amy Coney Barrett, do you want to go anywhere and hurt a local business? So you're going to end up holed up at some house surrounded by security at some lake? So here's what President Biden said. You would think he'd have maturity in this moment. Cut 20.
Men who were protesting outside the White House yesterday.
Yes, keep protesting because keep making your point. It's critically important. We can do a lot of things to accommodate the rights of women in the meantime. But fundamentally, the only thing that's going to change this.
And the only thing he keeps saying from the press secretary to himself, keep protesting. People are upset. Just keep it peaceful. That's not going to work.
I think people are disgusted by this sort of behavior. And there's one other thing, Brian, that's clear as a bell here that these protesters and others can't seem to see, which is that Washington and the Supreme Court are not the arena for the abortion issue anymore. The arena is now the states and the state legislatures. And, excuse me, these protesters, if they want to get something done, get out to the states that don't have abortion rights and work for them. Try to get the legislatures to pass measures that will ensure that. They have a chance. My own view is that over time, we will have very few states that allow abortion all the way up to the moment of birth and very few that disallow them entirely. We will end up with a kind of compromises where they're allowed up to a certain period of time or they're not allowed, but they're exceptions and so on. And this will all work out. But in the meantime, the protests and all the noise is happening in the wrong place. The action is really not now in Washington.
But, Brady, they're making it worse by making up scenarios that don't exist. If women are not going to be able to leave their state, we'll provide transport. We're going to make it possible. If the women are going to be prosecuted for having an abortion, we'll make sure they have legal help. If there's contraception bans, we'll be able to step. What are you talking about? You're making up things that don't even matter to inflame the situation. Can anyone be mature here?
Well, it doesn't seem so at the moment. The debate looks remarkably silly and out of focus. You hear that women would not be able to be treated for ectopic pregnancies and so on. But there you go. I mean, that's not illegal anywhere in the country. And the action's now in the states. If you want to get something done on the issue, work in those places. Let the democratic process work.
Brit Hume, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Glad to talk to you, Brian, as always.
All right. Thank you, sir. 1-866-408-7669. That was Brit Hume. He put out a lot of questions. Even he's intrigued by this moment in political history. Don't move. Want to get your take in just a moment.
Giving you everything you need to know. You're with Brian Kilmeade. A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I always love having Brit Hume on, and to have John Odrozik to this hour. I thought it was really great. I do want to point out that we finally got, with all the pandemic, it took forever to finally organize and get four venues all set up. And I have four venues set up, and I hope you guys can join me. Maybe on all four of them. Why not? In Newark, New Jersey, Saturday, August 27th. I'll be talking about bringing inside Fox, bringing inside sports. Also, it's a lot of fun. And we talk about basically winning the war on history and why America has been great from the start. So August 27th, 2002, if you want to come down there in person, intimate studio, New Jersey Performing Arts Center. So that'll be go to BrianKilmeade.com. It'll just tell you how to buy the tickets. Then the next week, September 8th, in Albany, New York, at the Egg, Empire State Plaza in Albany, New York. Please join me there. Tickets are now available. And also VIP access. This is where you can meet before the show. In Brandon, Missouri, Saturday, November 12th. That'll be at City Hall Live. And that's when my book, The President of Freedom Fighter, comes out on paperback. And then the next day I'll be in Oklahoma. I hope I can do that at the Cox Convention Center in Tulsa. So please get your tickets early because I can't manufacture them, especially in this age of everybody making sure that it is COVID-friendly. So get your tickets early. I just go to BrianKilmeade.com or just go to Ticketmaster. You just find out about the Fox stories, inside sports stories. You'll be able to actually interact, and we'll talk about not only what's in the news, but in America's past. Told the right way. Brian Kilmeade here.
From the Fox News radio studios in New York City, fresh off the set of Fox and Friends, it's America's receptive voice, Brian Kilmeade.
Thanks so much for being here, everybody. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. A lot of you did not come to work for a week. That's fine. We were here. Took July 4th off. And then we were back. I get the sense, I had to wait a long time for an elevator, that people are back at 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan. I don't know about you. I know, too, in Virginia, I saw this story that Governor Youngkin said, hey, state workers, can you guys come back to work? And if not, you probably have to find another job. So many people have just quit. They don't want to work 5 days a week anymore. What happened to this country? We're going to be joined by Michael Goodwin shortly, and then we're going to talk to Michael Rubin, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, to talk about what the president's Saudi Arabian trip that I think he takes off on Tuesday. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's big three.
Number three.
I am here to sound the alarm about a psychopath killer in the Middle East with infinite resources who poses threat to his people, to the Americans, and to the planet.
That is Saad al-Abraari on 60 Minutes talking about what he thinks MBS is doing in Saudi Arabia. They're trying to kill his family. He was forced from the country. He's not happy. President Biden takes his old show on the road now. The big stop is Saudi Arabia. The problem is he needs them now, but vilified them for years. And it's no longer Obama's Middle East. It's Trump's, thanks to the Abraham Accords. But guess who gets no credit? Trump. Guess who gets no mention? The Abraham Accords. Will Joe blow this one up, too?
Number two.
Well, the buck never actually stops with him, does it? This is the beauty of Joe Biden and his presidency. It's never his fault. If it's not the Russians, then it's the Republicans or it's whoever.
That is Piers Morgan, Biden's two-pronged approach to the economy. Blame and deny.
Number one.
We joke about the fact that President Biden's getting older, but the fact that even his team is saying, you know, 10 days of consecutive work, that's just too much for the man.
And they were talking about coming home from the G7 before he went to Saudi Arabia. Dr. Nicole Sapphire from the New York Times lets you know that Joe must not go for re-election. In a damning report on his aging performance, which reaffirms what we've been saying since he campaigned in his basement. He's too old, and he lost his fastball and his sinker and his changeup. Michael Goodwin's got a huge repertoire, and he has not lost his fastball. New York Post columnist, Fox News contributor, joins us now. Michael, did you read the place they used to employ you, the New York Times? Put in a scathing column full of quotes from people that have been working with him about his ability to do this job. Did you read it?
Yes, Brian. It is shocking. And yes, I did my undergraduate work at the New York Times. But I mentioned two pieces in the last couple of months. And this, to me, is the confirmation. The first was that Democrats were talking about crime, and it was therefore, you know, Democratic candidates in a number of particularly cities, mayoral candidates, were talking about crime, and therefore crime was no longer a taboo subject among Democrats. That was the signal: you can campaign on crime, from the New York Times, which I think most people don't fully recognize, Brian, is the brains behind the Democratic Party, such as it is.
They lead
it. It really creates the talking points. It largely creates the agenda. It gives permission slips. It denies certain things. It has given a permission slip to talk about crime. And then more recently, it took the same treatment to Biden himself and this issue that people were looking for alternatives. And again, you saw the Democratic Party respond. You have more people talking about it. It's a more open thing. Should he run again? And now, finally, this piece. They do a poll, they commission a poll with Siena College, a legitimate pollster, and they come back with this finding, which is 64% of Democratic voters saying they would prefer a new standard bearer in 2024. 4%. I mean, Joe Biden is a dead man walking as far as Democrats are concerned. And I think the New York Times has taken up the mantle now. It's going to make sure it happens. I mean, the Times is nothing if it isn't the propaganda arm of the Democratic Party.
It's the Harris poll.
In addition to being its brain. So it's now
right.
It's now taken over the party's thinking on this issue.
60% of those polls are 65 and up. So don't act like it's a bunch of 30-year-old whippersnappers who don't have any patience for grandpa. Those people who are seniors say he shouldn't be president. David Gergen, quoted in the same article, says, I'm 80. I should not be president. I should not be running anything. And I'm not putting him down. He's putting himself down, saying that that's 80-year-olds. It's too much of a job right now. They point out, too, that he's aging before our eyes. He's walking back the comments in China, walking back his comments about Vladimir Putin must go. He mixed up Ukraine and Iran. A few times he's called Vice President Harris President Harris. He calls Senator Warner John Warner instead of Mark Warner. John Warner's dead. John Warner is currently the senator from Virginia, who is only a stone's throw away. They also talk about how they break down his schedule, the most damning. He can't work 5 days. 5 days, that's it. And he doesn't do anything at all at night, and they don't overload his schedule. You can't do that. You cannot do this job like this. And Peter Baker wrote it. Hardly wakes up in the morning thinking, I got to destroy Joe Biden today. So it makes you wonder if that's why Pritzker and Gavin Newsom are now out there.
Look, I mean, I think you're right. And there's another damning number in here, too, Brian, that you mentioned senior voters. 94%, this is in the Times survey, of Democrats under the age of 30 said they would prefer a different candidate. 94%! I mean, that's the end of the youth vote for the Democratic Party. And so, look, Joe Biden, it never made sense. I mean, you have to go, you think of 2020 and the whole thing that he campaigned from his basement because of COVID. I mean, it was a very strange election in so many ways. And here we got a president who's just not up to the job. And look, I think there's another element too, Brian, and it really is. I mean, Steve Hilton was making this point on Fox last night. The corruption, the Hunter Biden connection to so many of these countries and the money, you know, that Joe Biden has been in government his entire adult life. Where did he get all the money to buy these houses and things? Where did all this come from? And so I think that in many ways, Joe Biden is a relic. I've compared him to the Tammany Hall creatures of yore in New York, where they basically, as one of them said, I seen my opportunities and I took them. Government was a way to get rich. Government was a way to have power and protection for yourself and your friends and your family, right, and to make a lot of money doing it. And I just think it's undeniable that there is a thread, the big guy getting his 10% cut. This was not the first time Joe Biden got a cut of Hunter's money. I believe it with all my heart.
And by the way, where is the money? Is the money? What is going on there? And on some level, I've always thought this. I think that Hunter wants to do in his family. And I do. On some level, he's almost taunting them with that book and with these details, taping everything, putting voicemails in the cloud. Are you kidding? So I want you to hear, if you want to hear, this is a little bit of a non-sequitur, but it's the same genre. Kamala Harris was on Face the Nation, and I've never seen a bigger layup of an interview ever in my life. And listen to this question to Kamala Harris, cut four.
Finish this sentence for me. Americans need to vote for Democrats in November because
our democracy is on the ballot. Truly, truly. If you look at an issue like choice, it's on the ballot. A woman's right to make decisions about her own body and potentially what can happen in the not too distant future around issues like access to and making.
I mean, are you kidding me?
Well, and I love this idea, democracy is on the ballot. That is precisely what the Supreme Court said, that abortion should be decided in a democratic fashion. It should be decided by voters and their representatives. I mean, it said the same thing about the EPA and emissions. You know, everything, the Times wrote that the court lurches to the right. EPA and emissions was the same thing, in a sense, Brian. It said that Congress has to make these decisions, not the administrative state, not bureaucrats. You would think that people who really believe in democracy would say, yeah, that's the point of our Constitution, is that the powers are delegated to the federal government are few. It's most powers are delegated to the states and their representatives, which is the democratic process. I mean, why Democrats won't accept the democracy that's in the Constitution, why they want a big federal government with Supreme Court making all the decisions, that's, to me, anti-democratic.
Right. And lastly, the president of the United States is making the most of this Roe v. Wade. He's making up scenarios that don't exist. Abortion pills are going to be banned. If you go to another state, you're going to be arrested. Women aren't going to be able to travel. Same-sex marriage is going to be banned. You're not going to be able to use contraception. And then the president last week brings up this story of a 10-year-old that was raped, was a rape victim, and had to leave their state to get an abortion. Horrible. The only problem is it more than likely is not true. Never fact checked. According to the fact check, is it Glenn Kessler in the Washington Post? Nobody can find this story. Nobody could see any type of harassment complaint or any sexual assault story in this state. And how could he possibly get into a president's remarks and make up such a horrific story and not be true?
You know, I guess the first question would be, was it in the prepared remarks or did he ad lib it, as has been the issue with so many of his other mistakes, right? Yeah. That he was appointed to the Naval Academy, regime change in Russia. All of these things, they're not in the prepared remarks. Taiwan will defend Taiwan militarily. Three times he has said the same thing, and none of it is American policy. It's never part of the program. So this probably is another one of those where he makes it up. He thinks the story about the porter on Amtrak, right? Totally made up kind of stuff, and he repeats it. And so, yes, it's true. It seems as though the staff is running the office of the presidency, but they're not doing a very good job of running the president. I mean, he goes out there and says these things that are just not true, and this could be another one.
And it's a big one, and it's a 10-year-old that he said was a rape victim, and she was forced to have to travel out of state to Indiana to seek to terminate the pregnancy and maybe save her life. Great. Not happened. Didn't happen. So let's make everything worse. And the Supreme Court justice protests that he says keep protesting, make it peaceful, knowing that they're being harassed outside their homes, knowing that Justice Kavanaugh just got forced out of a Morton's restaurant. He doesn't mind that. I mean, that to me is just inexcusable. We'll see where this goes, Michael.
You know, Brian, it's not going anywhere good. And the problem is not just 2024, of course. It's the next 2 years. I mean, there's more than 2 years left in Joe Biden's term. And I've said to you numerous times, I don't see how he finishes this term. I mean, the way he's in obvious decline, the problems that have been created on his watch and the weakness that he projects internationally, it is hard to see how he's still there 2.5 years from now.
Yeah, repeat the line. It's hard to believe he's going to be there 2.5 years from now. That's what was in the prompter. So I just wanted to repeat that line. I mean, he actually repeated that line. Repeat the line. So, and by the way, his staffer should be fired. I mean, you know what you're dealing with, and you put that in the prompter.
Well, and those instructions, right? The cheat sheet. You take your seat.
Yeah.
Well, whose seat should he take? I mean, whose seat would he take if it wasn't written down? He should take his own seat. I mean,
he had a card in his hand. For people at home to know, he had a card in his hand to say, when you walk into the room, take your seat. And the most basic rudimentary things that you would think maybe an 8-year-old would need written out, maybe an 8-year-old, he has to have it written out as President of the United States. Unbelievable. Michael, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure, Brian. Thank you.
You got it. Listen, it's your turn next. I know you have a lot to say. 1-866-408-7669. We'll talk about that, the president's trip over to Saudi Arabia, and we'll talk about as well the economy, where you think it is, and why you're not buying that it's now Republicans' fault. Don't move.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I don't see any reason to think that we will have a serious recession. Inflation is our problem, and it is our top priority. And so I think, you know, perhaps a transition to a more traditional growth level, but I don't think we should be talking ourselves into a recession.
You know, Gina Raimondo was asked to put out there, and she's known as somebody that is relatively reliable for that administration. But she had absolutely no energy, was not convincing. I know when you get the Janet Yellens and the accountants of the world and people with the economies who are economics background, they're not used to broadcasting. So I'll give her that. But she was a former governor. You go out there and don't rah-rah me, but just let me know that you care, you understand, and you're convicted of what you say. There was no energy in that. So it's true. The president's got 3.6 unemployment. Should be happy. The president added 370,000 jobs. They thought he was going to add 280. Should be happy. But a lot of other stuff really has people discouraged. I mean, in, economically, just giving an example of what has people discouraged. Average gas is down 30 cents, but it's already just that's on $4.70 a gallon. That's an all-time high prior to this incredible, unprecedented surge. The average family has to spend another $460 in extra money on food and clothing and gas. The Fed is about to up the interest rates again. Might be good to the macroeconomists, but I don't hang out with macroeconomists. The average person says, I guess I'm putting off my house. I guess I'm not renegotiating my house. I guess I am not moving. I'm not getting my first house. I guess I will continue to rent. 40% of Americans say the number one priority is inflation. 50% of you say the personal finances are a major issue now in the Biden economy. To me, that's pretty significant. You have 80% fall off of the S&P, the 80% fall off of the S&P since 2022. And that's the real economy. I'm not cheering for inflation. I mean, I am not cheering for a recession. But the experts are saying the only thing that's keeping us out of this is the fact that we have 11 million open jobs, 7 million without a job. And that's what's doing it. And the rest of the world is sucking wind. The supply chains have not been solved. Simple things like air travel has not been addressed. We're not having the trains aren't running on time. Our goods aren't getting here on time. Things cost more. Look around. If there's anything we expected from our politicians is not to run our lives, it's just to do the things that allow us to run our lives effectively. And this administration, mostly through their own moves, starting with oil and gas, and our reputation with Afghanistan, is solely to blame. Michael Rubin next.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
This administration is full bore in relations with China. China is probably the largest human rights abuser on the face of the planet, although Russia is trying to give them a run for their money. And we've had relations with Saudi Arabia for 90 years, actually 91, because the diplomatic relations were established in 1931. So this is a little bit late, but look, picking up a page from Trump and trying to move it forward and get Saudi into the Abraham Accords would be a great step forward. We shouldn't be over there begging oil.
Right. Now, that is Robert Charles, former naval intelligence officer, and also had roles in the State Department. Michael Rubin joins us now, senior fellow at AEI, where he specializes in Iran, Turkey, and the broader Middle East. President's going to the Middle East. Michael, it's a much different Middle East than the president last visited 6 years ago, wouldn't you say?
I would, absolutely. Unfortunately for President Biden, it seems to be a little bit too little too late. His strategy is falling on deaf ears. He just seems completely out of touch with the reality, and I'm afraid that moving forward with his Saudi trip, it's not going to end well for him.
Saudis reportedly already have parameters. They do not want to talk about any social issues. They don't want to talk about human rights. They don't want to talk about Khashoggi, and they will not even put on the table their oil alliance with Russia.
Well, you're absolutely right, Brian. I mean, the Saudis feel like they're in the driver's seat. They also believe that President Joe Biden humiliated them for purely domestic reasons. They don't believe that he understands the threats which the Iranian-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen play. And when it comes to that oil production alliance with Moscow, remember, that's what the Biden administration blames in part for the high oil prices. So it's curious what Joe Biden expects to get. When we talk about the Saudis having long memories, they're still complaining about the way they were treated during the oil embargo back in the 1970s. This notion that President Biden, for his progressive base, can bash a longtime ally that's always stood behind us when we needed them, and then turn around and support us after the gratuitous treatment which Joe Biden dispensed to them, it really is unbelievable.
So just picture this. For people that don't really want to memorize the region or travel there, just know it's important. And understand this, the Houthi rebels take over a friendly government. Whatever you thought of the Yemeni government, they were friendly to the Saudis. The Houthi rebels are supported by Iran. Without Iran's support, they don't exist, or they're not an effective force. And they decide to start lobbing rockets into Saudi Arabia. So Saudi Arabia—
And not only—
Rockets, and Saudi Arabia starts hitting back, and now they're the, because they were, listen, Saudis weren't smooth what they were doing with the blockade and everything, but they were responding to attacks, correct?
That's absolutely correct, and let's just be clear, they weren't attacking military targets. They were lobbing rockets at civilian airfields, not only in Saudi Arabia, but also in the United Arab Emirates. Now, when we look at President Joe Biden's op-ed, which he wrote a couple days ago in the Washington Post to presage this trip, what Joe Biden showed in that op-ed is he simply doesn't understand the Saudi security concerns. Now, this denialism that the rockets there were really Iranian-backed, let me tell you this. I used to live in Yemen, as you know. I've gone to arms markets in Yemen. When I've been to arms markets in Yemen, I didn't see any anti-ship missiles in the desert markets of Yemen. Those anti-ship missiles are recent imports through the Islamic Republic of Iran. The Saudis aren't going to put their national security on the line for what they see as Joe Biden trying to relieve domestic pressure, because unfortunately his record back in the United States on resolving the petroleum prices, inflation, and so forth is so poor.
We're speaking with Michael Rubin about the president's upcoming trip to Saudi Arabia. So we know in sometime in campaign rhetoric, you say things to get attention to win elections. I got it. But out of nowhere, he talked about how much contempt he has for Saudi Arabia, how he says they're a pariah in the region. They were going to be isolated, and he was basically going to demand reforms and not interact. He has totally changed his tune, because one is real politics. It's like they're not perfect, but they're our preferred ally. And one is some fantasy world in which Saudi Arabia doesn't matter. And that world, even Donald Trump as a rookie politician, picked up right away. And he was able to leverage the Saudi and Israeli flourishing relationship to normalize trade relations with Israel and other nations. And right now, even though it's not formalized, Israel does not have an enemy in Saudi Arabia, because they have one thing in common. They all hate Iran. What has the president done with Iranian relations that's different from Trump's, Michael Rubin?
Well, if you actually look at the timeline of Iran's nuclear program, what you find is that the Iranians waited until Joe Biden was in office before they ratchet up their uranium production, because they were afraid of Trump. They're not afraid of Biden. Now, when Biden writes before his trip that he's committed to continuing with this 2015 nuclear deal that no one but himself and his progressive base thinks works, that's something that doesn't go over well with the Saudis. They don't feel that he understands their security needs. Now, it's fair to criticize Saudi human rights, although in a diplomatic way. But two things here. Is it better to throw the baby out with the bathwater, push Saudi Arabia into the arms of China and Russia, which is what he did? At the same time, I hate to tell you this, but there's no angels in the Middle East. This notion that somehow the Houthis are angels and the Saudis are deserving of contempt, that's not the way you treat American allies. That's not the way to signal that diplomacy is back.
Absolutely not. It'll blow up. And why not just acknowledge the Abraham Accords and build on it? I mean, in the past, one administration to the next would pick up Middle East policy. They change it. I got it. But you have a change of embassy. You have a change in Middle East for the better. And now the Palestinian issue has been marginalized with that corrupt government. People are recognized there. You can't deal with them. So why not just take advantage of that? Having said that, how do you think this will come out this week?
Well, ultimately, I can't imagine that the Saudis are going to try to throw Joe Biden a life raft before the November 2022 elections. They might treat him politely. There might be some high-level snubs, however. But ultimately, I think that Joe Biden is going to come back empty-handed. If he wants to address oil prices at home, he's got to be serious about domestic oil production. He can't hope for any life rafts from those whom he's bashed around in the Middle East.
Here's what Governor Greg Abbott said just about that. Cut 18.
It's so embarrassing and so two-faced by the Biden administration, going off to Saudi Arabia, begging for them to produce more oil when we have the oil right here in the state of Texas. Texas is one of the, if not the most prolific producer of oil in the entire world.
Obviously, and he keeps vilifying oil and gas by not producing enough and not refining fast enough when maximum refinery capacity has been reached. And he's been vilifying fossil fuels from before he was elected.
You're absolutely right there. He simply shoots from the cuff. He believes that his Democratic base is what's reflected on Twitter. He doesn't realize how far out of the mainstream Twitter and he are right now. And let's also look at fossil fuels. The fact of the matter is, with technology, they've become a lot more clean. You can't expect people who are trying to live paycheck to paycheck to prioritize some super expensive alternative energy, which frankly doesn't work all that well anyway. Frankly, Joe Biden just seems out of his element, and the Saudis are completely frustrated by this, even if they wanted to work with his administration.
So I see him heading over to the Middle East and seeming desperate and being able to walk it back. But you know what's interesting? His left wing of his base is upset at him. They don't want him going over there.
Well, that's ultimately what I mean. There's this notion that there's some sort of angel in the Middle East. What Joe Biden needs to understand is what every president, Democrat and Republican before him understood, that we are under threat by the ideology of the Islamic Republic of Iran. In the founding statutes of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, it defines the purpose as export of revolution, which the Iranians in turn defined as waging insurgency. There's no way to diplomatically explain that. He's got to be serious about the Iranian problem, and until he is, it doesn't matter what the domestic base thinks. He's going to lose the outside world. Again, so much for diplomacy being back. If Joe Biden is so arrogant, he refuses to look at perspectives outside Washington.
And the people he's dealing with are irrational. They think we're going to turn to windmills. They think we're going to turn to solar panels and be able to make up for high gas and oil prices or fossil fuels. Listen to Congresswoman and fellow squad member Pramila Jayapal. Listen to this, Cut 14.
I don't think that this is a good idea. I think that we are essentially sublimating human rights at this point with the president going for this visit. That's not to say that I don't think that the United States should have engagement with countries that we disagree with, but to have the president go, essentially what feels to me a bit of hat in hand, begging for help on the oil front, when we know that the president knows and has been clear about this during the campaign, that Saudi Arabia and MBS have committed incredible atrocities, war crimes with Khashoggi, and we know that there hasn't been accountability for that yet.
Unbelievable. Final thought?
What's actually interesting is even the Turks have dropped their criminal court case against MBS with regard to Khashoggi. Look, when I talk to Saudi liberals very quickly, what they say is the narrative we have here about chopping up a journalist is wrong. Now, that's wrong, too. But what they say is, the way they see it, is one Saudi intelligence officer was killed by other Saudi intelligence officers for a reason they don't know. The situation is much more complicated, and it pays for Joe Biden to listen to his experts in the intelligence community and so forth, rather than simply listen to the squad on Twitter.
Yeah, I would think so. And I would think that would be his instincts. And his instincts are being ill-served by his chief of staff, Ron Klain, whose job it is, whose beat it is to work the squad. And he seems to be won over by the squad, and it's going into every speech the president gets. And those important lines, we all know he wants to repeat them because they wrote it in the prompter. Michael, thanks so much. And last, before we go, just real quick, do you think Turkey's going to have any success working to with Russia on opening up the Black Sea?
Turkey is working fist in glove with Russia to help Russia evade sanctions. They're not interested in opening the Black Sea unless they get paid handsomely for it.
So that's a no. Michael Rubin, yeah. By the way, they are NATO. I don't know why, but they are. Michael Rubin, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brian.
You got it. 1-866-408-7669. We come back. I'll have a chance to open up the phones and find out what you have to say. Also, if you want to write me, you're at work, briankilmeade.com. Just click on comments. Don't move.
Expanding your knowledge base. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I am here to sound the alarm about a psychopath, killer, in the Middle East with infinite resources, who poses threat to his people, to the Americans, and to the planet.
A psychopath.
A psychopath with no empathy, doesn't feel emotion, never learned from his experience. And we have witnessed atrocities and crimes committed by this killer.
That is former intelligence director that worked hand in glove reportedly with Mike Morrell, former CIA director and assistant CIA director for a couple of administrations, who people really respected here reportedly. I know people have complex issues, but especially when it comes to the Saudis, who was forced out of power by MBS, the 34-year-old prince who runs the country. The king is old and decrepit, and he's the one behind the Khashoggi killing by almost all accounts. Now, everybody that was with Najaf, the old leader, is hunted down. That's the way the Middle East works. It's terrible. That happens constantly, as you know. It's the way the Russians work, too, by the way, and the way the Chinese work. So they're hunted down. Now, this guy is in Canada, decided to speak anyway to 60 Minutes, and say he's a horrible person that's capable of doing anything. So that's the downside of working at MBS. And having said all that, most intelligence experts agree, and other administrations have concluded, that MBS is the person to work for. That's why it was so unbelievably irresponsible of the President of the United States to use that as a talking point during his time when he was a candidate, when he was former chairman of foreign relations and knows there's a downside to alienating Saudi Arabia. Who's going to replace him? Iran? And what the president's trying to do is get Iran back into the family of nations in order to get their oil back in the market to bring the price down, which is a lark. They're never going to do that. Ron, and thankfully the Iranians are holding off. Ron, you're listening on KSLM in Oregon. Hey, Ron.
Brian, I'm going to tell you right now, this president is doing everything America allows to destroy us. It's cost me an extra $4,000 so far this year on my food and my fuel. Yes, I drive a diesel. It gets 21 miles to a gallon, which is very good because we do extra stuff to get the best efficiency possible. What this president is doing is basically kicking Israel in the teeth, destroying our alliance with, since Calvin Coolidge, the alliance that we have with Saudi Arabia, and everything else to cater to China, to make us less, make us vulnerable. They're attacking, as a Navy person from 32 years ago, I've been out attacking our ships, threatening our allies. And we're going to go back to the table with Iran so we can be subservient and be the laughingstock of the world. And you wonder why Saudi Arabia can go. Name me one president like Trump that talked to Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Israel on one trip and pitched things up to let trash things together, including Abraham Accords with Sudan and other countries. And yet this guy or the people that's running this decrepit gentleman –
Ron, I understand your frustration. You don't need a degree from Brown University to understand that he had a Middle East that was much more settled. He had momentum going to bring Saudi Arabia in the most to have trade relations and recognize the existence of Israel. He had a chance to do all that, even with the change in leadership with Israel, and he didn't do it because it's the Abraham Accords, and that was Trump's thing. And he wouldn't even acknowledge that, which shows an insecurity that goes beyond somebody that's been doing this for 40 years. It's crazy. The other big story, of course, is Roe v. Wade and how the president is reacting to that. He, instead of calming things down and saying vote, and I understand you want to make an election issue, you want to make sure the carnage is not that bad in the midterms. I would say this. What you do is don't bring up the fact that contraception is next. Same-sex marriage is on the docket. That they're not going to allow women are going to be arrested if they go to another state in order to have an abortion. You don't do that. Instead, he does all those things, inflames things that already have people on edge. Listen to Vice President Harris.
Did Democrats fail past Democratic presidents, congressional leaders, to not codify Roe v. Wade over the past 5 decades?
I think that, to be very honest with you, I do believe that we should have rightly believed, but we certainly believe that certain issues are just settled.
Clearly we're not.
No, that's right. And that's why I do believe that we are living, sadly, in real unsettled times.
Perfect. That settles it. So that's Vice President Harris. Had the biggest series of layup questions you will ever get as a world leader, ever. As a U.S. leader. I'm not sure what the rest of the world would do. But they're giving her more stuff to do. They're putting her in more press conferences. They're seeing if she can do it. It also shows that they lost confidence in the president as the Democratic Party. This is her audition. And if you watch that interview, you cannot feel great about it. Hey, go to BrianKilmeade.com. Find my four live shows. Get tickets near you.
From the Fox News Radio studios in New York City, giving you opinions and facts with a positive approach, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Thanks so much for being here, everybody. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show, 1-866-408-7669. Jonathan Turley has been summoned, and he's responded to the call. He'll be with us to break down some of these protests, the horrible protests at Morton's. Justice Kavanaugh doesn't seem to bother the administration at all. Don't they know it's not going to stop there? Are they familiar with the fact that they have people that don't like them and that they will find out where their cabinet secretaries live and their officers live and their administrators live because they are encouraging people to protest and have no problem with doing it at residences or at restaurants? I can't believe that. Maybe he can. Gianna Russo will be joining us at the bottom of the hour, one of our favorite all-time guests, author of The Hollywood Godfather, who had many interactions with James Caan. And who was famous as Sonny in The Godfather, and famous Brian song? I want to get his take on that mob, on the mob and James Caan and where it goes. He's also in his book. So we'll talk about both those things, but let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
I am here to sound the alarm about a psychopath killer in the Middle East with infinite resources, who poses threat to his people, to the Americans, and to the planet.
And they're talking about MBS, but the president's going to meet with him anyway. And that was Saad Alibari, who used to work with Najaf, who used to be a prince that was in power in Saudi Arabia, but was ousted by MBS. Biden takes his old show on the road, the big stop, Saudi Arabia. The problem is he needs them now, but will vilify them for years, and it's no longer Obama's Middle East. We'll explain.
Number two.
Well, the buck never actually stops with him, does it? This is the beauty of Joe Biden and his presidency. It's never his fault. If it's not the Russians, then it's the Republicans or it's whoever.
That is Piers Morgan, of course. Biden's two-pronged approach to the economy, blame and deny.
Number one.
We joke about the fact that President Biden's getting older, but the fact that even his team is saying, 10 days of consecutive work, that's just too much for the man.
Yeah, that is Dr. Nicole Sapphire responding to that huge story about Joe Biden's schedule that reveals he is not on his game. Even the New York Times says Joe must not go for re-election. In a damning report on his aging and his performance and his work ethic, we'll discuss that. But first things first, Jonathan Turley, welcome back.
Thank you.
He is a law professor at George Washington University, as well as a contributor here. First off, I just got to get your take on the Morton story. The fact that Justice Kavanaugh has to leave out the kitchen with his family because of protesters on the outside. He gets protested at home. He can't go out to dinner with his family. Jonathan, you must be incensed.
I am. And what's disturbing is that this should not be a difficult call. It would not be a difficult call for the vast majority of Americans. But it seems to be an insurmountable burden for the president and his cabinet members to simply condemn this practice. Nobody is questioning the right to protest. That's often the only point they address. Nobody's saying they don't have that right. What we're saying is it's wrong. You can use things that you have a right to do in a wrong way. And this is wrong. It's wrong to harass and hound judges and justices because you don't agree with how they interpret the Constitution. And it's dangerous. This was an individual who just recently had an alleged attempted murder take place at his house. He was an attempted assassination of this justice. And yet people like Buttigieg and others can't get themselves to simply condemn it and to say, it's too much. We can protest and we can object
And we could be passionate, but we don't have to hound and harass members of the bench because they hold a different view of the Constitution.
No kidding. And it's not going to stop. And there's no sign that it'll stop. Now they're putting bounties. If you have a justice sound sighting, you can get $250 or more. So if you see Clarence Thomas at the lake or Amy Conan Barrett at, in Aruba, you're supposed to alert local protesters. And it just leads me to this other thing. Is this people feeling acting emotionally and passionately, or are these people being paid? And who's paying them?
Well, I think part of it is obviously people are paying it, but we also have a nation that is becoming addicted to rage, and it isn't a new thing. I remember years ago you were followed by two nutcases in the subway, and I was really appalled by it because it was just the faces of these individuals following you through the metro and how much they were enjoying it. And you realized that you could become addicted to rage, and that's what we saw in your case. That's what we see outside these houses. And it's going to take the entire American people to say to President Biden and other leaders, that's not enough. You know, it's not enough to say people are upset. It's like when Nancy Pelosi was asked about people destroying a statue in her city. And she said, well, people will do what people will do. Well, what does that say to violent people?
It says go do it. And then it gets those people that are on the other side of any issue to respond. For example, do you really think that the Supreme Court justices are the only one that are going to tick these political activists off? I mean, there are Republican activists, too, that are very angry, let's say, at the press secretary. Let's say at the Secretary of Transportation that you can't get on a flight today. The supply chain situation. So what's going to stop everyday people that are not at the White House, that don't have armed guards, from all of a sudden, next thing you know, their residences turn on the ground? Because this is going to get out of control. The only reason he has no problems with it is because he totally is upset about the Roe v. Wade decision. He's upset about the EPA decision. He's upset about the gun decision. So he says the Supreme Court has acted irresponsibly. What message is that to send?
Well, I think that's the real missing element here. That is, when you look at Uvalde, you look at Highland Park, we have a crisis of mental illness in this country. There are people who are disturbed and violent. And we constantly talk about that when we have these tragedies occur. But these politicians don't take responsibility for how they fuel that. And it can happen on both the left and the right. But to have this level of difficulty, to simply tell these protesters, there's a point where you have a right, but you can abuse that right, and this is it. You know, you disagree with Justice Kavanaugh. Fine, protest at the Supreme Court. Organize on the election level. You don't have to harass and try to intimidate these justices. What's also interesting, by the way, is that Kavanaugh has been the fifth vote on critical votes this last term, supporting the more liberal justices. I mean, they're harassing a justice who, next to Roberts, is probably the most likely to support the left of the court.
Absolutely. And even with the gun lobby, with the gun decision, he had those two-page insert that said, just come up with different restrictions you want and submit them. Of course, New York went over the top and most likely going to go back to court. But how about this story? Joe Biden, in an attempt to get to swing votes and limit the damage done at the midterms, is expounding on what could happen with Roe v. Wade overturned. He's saying next contraception. He's saying they're going to stop women from traveling. They're going to try to charge women that get abortions out of that state if they're residents of a state that doesn't allow them. They're going to talk about getting rid of contraception, all to panic people and, gets this, enrage them. Then he brings up this story, Jonathan Turley, of a 10-year-old that was raped and had to go to Indiana to get an abortion. The problem is nobody knows what the hell he's talking about. It's not rooted in any fact people have been able to track through government officials, through any abuse, through abortions that were done. How could he have made up this story?
Well, what we know about that story is it all came from a single doctor who said that she received a call from another physician, but that doctor has refused to speak with media since giving that story over. And even the Washington Post said that's really not good journalism. You need some support before you run with a story like that. And if it doesn't constitute good journalism, it doesn't constitute good politics either for a president to base it on without us really knowing what the facts are and what occurred. But his entire remarks were just completely baffling. I mean, he accuses the Supreme Court of ignoring early cases on abortion. It's totally untrue. It was almost laughingly untrue, because the criticism of the court is that it's by the left is that it spent too much time talking about the early laws that governed abortion. But he also, in his remarks, said we have to protect the right to travel. Well, that's ridiculous. I mean, the right of women to travel, to receive medical care or any purpose is protected under the United States Constitution as long as it is, lawful. I mean, you could have interstate criminal cases, but you cannot be prevented from going to another state for medical or abortion services. The Supreme Court has been incredibly strong on this point, and it's just not credible. You have other Democratic members who have said that ectopic pregnancies are also going to be prevented by this decision. That's entirely untrue. That's not a viable pregnancy, and the treatment is not an abortion. But not putting that aside, there's two other problems. Most of these states, like Texas, Louisiana, Oklahoma, specifically exempt those procedures. And you already have a standard that easily protected them even if they didn't. And so a lot of this parade of horribles tends to disperse once you get closer. Now, that doesn't mean that there's not significant issues here. There is a significant
absolutely.
Issue. You know, they just said that abortion is not a right protected by the Constitution. People are totally in good faith in arguing the other side of that. But you don't have to do what the president did and try to suggest that there are these other things that the opinion endangers, when in fact it does not.
It's very similar to the pandemic where, did you hear that vaccine does this? Did you hear it's easy to catch here? Do you hear you shouldn't shake hands? No, where'd you hear that? Well, a lot of people speaking irresponsibly off the cuff or with hearsay. This is extrapolating from a decision to try to incense people, in my humble opinion, to be motivated to vote a certain way. The president also brought this up in terms of action he could take. The audio is not great, but I wanted you to hear it through all his executive action. Cut 21.
One of the things they are asking for is a public health emergency. Is that something you're considering?
That's something I've asked the folks, the medical people in the administration, to look at whether that is, whether I have the authority to do that or anything like that. Okay?
So he wants to declare a possible public health emergency. Does that have standing?
No, even the dog in the background seems to be objecting. If you actually go to the president's own agency and their site, they explain accurately that this is not a public health emergency. They refer to that status as dealing with diseases and other types of illness that are rapidly spreading across the country. It doesn't even come close to something like this. And also the president's own staff admitted that they looked at this and obviously dismissed it. They said that they didn't see how this would free up significant funds or significant authority, but what it would do is trigger litigation. And so the question is, why do it? And the answer is because this is a political health emergency, that by calling it, using that type of term, it gives the impression of action. It's like creating threats that are not in the opinion, like saying that soon you won't be able to get contraceptives, even though the Supreme Court repeatedly and expressly said that is not the case and that its decision is not to be used for that purpose.
Lastly, I worked hard on Friday to try to digest, I think it was Friday, his executive order during our show, not having the legal background that you have. I can't see any substance in these executive orders. I don't even know what it was supposed to do besides allow him to rant afterwards. Do you? Like, what actionable did he put forward?
Well, it's fitting. It comes just before the free Slurpee day. I mean, the problem is that there's very little nutritional value in that executive order. It basically says you need to support the right that women have to abortion. Well, it's somewhat limited what you can do because the Supreme Court just returned this issue to the states. But what the White House is not saying while raising these other issues that are not in peril is that the majority of women in this country, in all likelihood, will be in states that protect the right of abortion. The blue states have a very high percentage of our population, and many of those states go way beyond Roe. States like Colorado support abortion up to 9 months, so that is way beyond where Roe required. And by the way, only 10% of the country, according to a Harvard poll, actually supports that type of law. But also, over about 60% of abortions are handled with an abortion pill, which is very likely to continue to be available. And so, once again, there's lots of good reasons that opponents have to oppose this decision. I understand that. But we really do have some obligation to be accurate and to try to put this into perspective for the public to know what it is we are debating. The president said in his remarks, vote, 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 vote. Well, that's what the court said. The Supreme Court, he said, you know, we'll accept that challenge. Well, fine. The Supreme Court said, look, in 1973, we stopped a political debate in this country, and now you can have at it. And said, this is up to the American people.
That simple. You could either do that as a leader, or you could say, I'm going to get people off the charts angry, and the ripple effects you're going to be responsible for. Jonathan Turley, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
All right. By the way, the President of the United States in the Rose Garden right now commemorating the passage of that bipartisan gun law. Well, not very popular with the right, but 14 votes at least from Republicans. And what it did is didn't ban AR-15s. It didn't raise the age from 18 to 21 to buy a weapon. It did have money put aside to give the states to help implement a red flag law with certain parameters, which would change it from the Wild West, from the big blue states that are very restrictive, to the red states that had very few restrictions. And it was a fine achievement. But the president, as usual, he asked for a lot, was angry, blamed the NRA, and then behind closed doors, the senators just actually went to work. And I think they got something effectively done that I think, if implemented, would have stopped the shooting over on July 4th. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. We're going to come back. We have some open time, for open lines, and then we'll talk to Gianna Russo about the role of James Caan and the mob, and also that series I love on Paramount Plus called The Offer. He's in it. Not as himself, but he's portrayed in it. Brian Kilmeade.
Educating, entertaining, enlightening. You're with Brian Kilmeade. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back. Just a quick announcement. You know, I've been on stage before when I do my book tours, and I've enjoyed it so much. I have a chance to look back at the world of the American history, and I had no idea we'd be having to push back on American history and get it right because everyone's trying to rewrite it now. The latest story is on the front page of the New York Post today, how they're trying to, and Monticello, they're actually running down Thomas Jefferson's life and legacy, building up the slave culture there and vilifying him at his own home that was been a tourist site since 1920. And guess what? If you watch Saturday's show, they're doing the same thing to James Madison. If you want to win the war in history and see it on stage, go to BrianKilmeade.com. You'll find out where I'll be. August, September, and two dates in November. And you can get tickets right now, including VIP opportunities.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
You have to answer for Santino, Carlo.
Mike, you got it all wrong.
You fingered Sonny for the Barzini people.
Ah, that little farce you played with my sister. You think that could fool the Corleone?
Mike, I'm innocent. I just run the kids. Please, Mike, don't do this to me.
Barzini's dead. So is Philip Tattaglia, Mo Green, Stracci, Cuneo. Today I settle all family business, so don't tell me you're innocent, Carlo. Now, who approached you? Tartaglia or Barzini?
It was Barzini.
That is Godfather, the first, the original. Gianni Russo knew that right away. He's the author of Hollywood Godfather, My Life in the Movies, and The Mob. He was kind enough to help us on a Wise Guy special looking back 50 years since Godfather 1, and he was in it himself. And he's portrayed, I believe, in The Offer, which is a series I'm not done with, but it's fantastic on Paramount Plus, which is based on the making of The Godfather. Gianni, welcome back.
Thank you, my man. How you been? All right?
Good. Thanks for helping us out on that special. As usual, you're the MVP. You provided the glue to bring us through the reality and the actual acting because you were in it, and then the aftermath and what this and what the mob was all about, a word that they could not use in The Godfather. But I wanted to get your reaction to James Caan's passing. You knew him. You first met him on the set of The Godfather. Am I right?
I met him at rehearsal at Patsy's, 119th Street. And he didn't like me then, and he went to his grave not liking me now.
Why? What did he not like about you?
I don't know. You know, it's so funny. I tried to figure it out. I wasn't an actor. I was 27 years of age. My ego, I wanted to be in the movie. And the good news, I felt very comfortable because Patsy's on 119th Street. I used to go there all the time. That's Fat Tony Salerno's. That was the Genovese family. And I was working for Costello, who was their boss, basically, as a messenger. So I used to go up there all the time with $5,000, $10,000 midnight loans, used to call them, because of the Zig and Ed games. So when they said the rehearsal was there, I said, great. So I got there early. I'm in a Brioni suit. I got a Chinese chick driving my 65 Bentley. And here comes all these guys that, you know, I never met before. Sterling Hayden, Richard Conte, all these guys. And, you know, James Caan. And they gave us instructions, which I thought was interesting. They said, when Brando gets in the room, no eye contact, don't approach him. And then we were all sitting around this table in order of the family. It was Brando, Morgana King, then Sonny, Fredo, Michael, Diane Keaton, Ty, and me. You know, so we were all there. And then we had to introduce ourselves. And when I got up, they were all looking at me saying, who's this guy? I'm dressed in a Brioni suit. They're dressed like my gardener dressed better than them.
Right.
Diane Keaton had combat boots on. I couldn't believe it. But then, you know, at the break, Brando came to me. Now, I don't know if that ruffled Jimmy's feathers because, you know, Jimmy's this thespian and wanted to bond with him and all of that. And they all went to, you know, Stella Adler and the Strasbourg, all these schools. And I don't know. Then I thought maybe he's staying in character and he just wants to, you know, that's who he is. He's a method actor.
Right. And he wasn't. But Brando walked over to you and was talking to you, and you think that maybe James Caan was jealous?
Everybody was in the room. And I didn't know protocol because that was the first time I was in a rehearsal or on a set. And they told us don't even look at him. But when he came to me, he was actually trying to get me fired. And I picked up on it after three or four sentences because he said to Coppola, he said, you know, this guy has got to be an important guy, a major actor. See, prior to calling Coppola over, he said, you're a big TV actor. I said, no. He said, you have a big movie coming out. I said, no. He said, well, you're not on Broadway. I know everybody on Broadway. I said, you're right again. What's this, a quiz show? So he said, who'd you study with? I said, study what? What are you talking about? And then he tells Coppola, this guy's got to be a great actor. He undermines my whole family. You got to rethink this. And I'm saying, wait a minute, this guy's trying to get me fired. So again, not knowing protocol, I said, Francis, go over there a minute. I dismissed the director. The whole room went quiet because Coppola walked away. I put my arm on Brando and walk him in the back where the Zig and Ed game would be going on. I knew it wasn't going
on. What is a Zig and Ed game?
It's an Italian, very hard dice and cards. It's a major game. Big money in it. But anyway, so I get him out of earshot. I don't want to embarrass the guy. And I said, let me tell you something, okay? All due respect, I know who you are, but you get me fired. Listen to me carefully. You get me fired, I will suck on your heart. You will bleed out here. You can't embarrass me like this. He looked at me. He stepped back. He said, that was brilliant. You could really do this part. He thought I was acting. I meant it. Because everybody I told was going to be in the movie. He said, how are you going to be in that movie? You're not an actor.
Well, tell everyone, Gianni, how you got in the movie.
Well, I got in the movie, and it's not what's in the offer. Because in the offer, they're saying, you know, they treat me like a bum, actually. People will call me. I won't watch it. Even the kid that got the part called me because he read my book, Hollywood Godfather. He said, Mr. Russo, I just got cast to play you. Is it all if I do? I said, well, it's very nice of you to call me. He said, well, no, I read your book. I'll ask you first. But the good news, it's right now, I can't believe I'm in a James Patterson book right now. It just came out, called Defense Attorney. It's about Barry Slotnick. And Barry Slotnick was in the room with Joe Colombo at Gulf and Weston when Joe Colombo told Bobby Evans, Stanley Jaffe, Al Ruddy, and all of them, you want me to cooperate with you? Gianni Russo plays Carlo. And they all looked at each other, and they were dumbfounded, and he caught them off guard. He said, okay. That's how I got the part. And for your audience, James Patterson book, page 70, 71. Whatever you're watching on the offer, Look at that.
So I got you. So Gianni, that's how you got the part.
That's how I got the part.
Let me tell you something. So I think it's, first off, I know it's about James Caan in particular. He didn't like you, but did you like him? I mean, was he a hard guy to get along with? I know that Megyn Kelly and said that he might have been in the mob.
He's in no mob. He's Jewish, number one. That's all he wanted to be. Ever since he played Sonny Corleone, he went to his grave thinking he was Sonny Corleone. He hooked up with all kinds of wise guys, Junior Persico, Andrew Mush, all those guys. He went to see them in prison after this picture. He went to Gotti's trial. I mean, this guy was nuts.
So you're not going to miss him. This is not the tribute I thought it would be.
Oh, did you see yesterday's New York Post?
No.
Oh, my God. I did a story yesterday by 11 o'clock in the morning. It was 107,000 views. By the end of the day, it was over 2 million. You got to get it.
I will get it. I will take
it. Page 3, no less, they gave me.
And just talked about James Caan. So you were not a fan.
Oh, I buried him.
All right.
Literally. Along with his family.
So tell me about in the making of The Godfather, which I find endlessly fascinating, Al Ruddy, I know you don't like the way you were portrayed in it. They say that James Caan really beat you up in that scene because he was told to by the director.
That's such a lie.
Not true.
I could sue the whole company. How do you have somebody beat me up? He chipped my elbow, broke two ribs. Now they're saying, you just gave me that young, I'll call my lawyer. Sue Paramount.
Right, so you did get beat up?
Yes, by Jimmy Caan.
Right, but you said that was part of the scene.
It was part of the scene. We rehearsed it for a day. And then the next day we came back to shoot it. There was no bat when he got out of that car in rehearsal. That was something he ad-libbed. He must have been practicing all night because when he got out of the car and threw the bat, he hit me right on the head. We stopped the scene a minute because I did get hurt a little bit. I said, no, let's keep going. And then when he threw me over the railing and he's beating me with that metal, garbage pail cover, not like plastic ones we have today. They were steel those days. He chipped my elbow and I said, wow, this is crazy. And then when I crawl out to the railing and he drop kicks me, we had it all rehearsed. Soon as his toe hit me, I would roll over and into the fire hydrant. That's how the scene ends. That's when he said, you touch my sister again, I'll kill you. He broke two ribs, but it was like a football injury. When I got home, I was hurt and I couldn't inhale and exhale.
Wow. So here's how it sounded. Cut 38. It doesn't look like we have it, but it was more visual. That's when they show you getting beat up by Sonny. Lastly, just real quick, Gianni Russo, by the way, pick up his book, Hollywood Godfather. You will not be able to put it down. Gianni, real quick, In the offer, Al Ruddy, they said like he single-handed, he did a lot of extraordinary things in order to put this thing together. Does he deserve as much credit as they give him in the offer?
Well, you know, I haven't seen it. All I keep hearing is the Al Ruddy story. I did everything. Nobody did anything. In the offer, did they say I found the location up on Longfellow Road where we shot the wedding?
No.
See? Nope. Right. My grandfather knew the guy who owned the house. He was the gardener. And they were looking for the house. They lost the house in Manhasset. They were picketing everything. Joe Colombo didn't want this movie made in New York State. Could it, you know, Italian Defamation League.
Yep.
And I found the house up on Longfellow Road. I found La Rosa's pastries to make the cakes. The band that's in the movie, Nino Morielli, played at my first wedding on Staten Island.
So they don't give you any credit. That's bad. They have you in there in the movie. I know. Johnny. Oh,
you know what it is?
Well, go ahead.
I own quarterly owned Fine Italian Foods. Go online. I own it. I own all the liquors in 73 countries. When Michael said at the end of the movie, no, Carla, your punishments, you're out of the family business. Yes. I own them all. I own Genco olive oil now throughout the world.
Awesome. Gianni, thanks so much. Gianni Russo, thank you. Appreciate it. Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. It's Brian Kilmeade. Welcome back. At top of the hour, I'm going to be on Outnumbered. I'll be the guy in the middle. Meanwhile, I'm just looking at my watch. I'm just thinking, you need to know more.
More to know.
Leonardo DiCaprio offered Pete Buttigieg some speaking tips during his presidential run. Must have not worked too well, right? According to a political strategist named Liz Smith, the former senior communications director for Buttigieg, tells TMZ that Leo offered private coaching session and Pete ahead of a national televised debate. Leo extended the offer back in 2019 during a swanky private fundraiser for Pete in Los Angeles mansion, included there Paris Hilton, Ashton Kutcher, Katy Perry, Orlando Bloom. We're also told that most celebrities like Paris just took selfies with Pete and exchanged pleasantries. Leo went a step further, giving Buttigieg the ultimate offer during a conversation in one of their mansions back rooms. Leo's pitch went like this. He would help Pete with the speaking style and coach him up on the best way to deliver his talking points. Really? I know he's a great actor, but he's not a great motivating speaker, right?
And when is he like a political expert, right? And goes on to say that Lise was ecstatic when Pete told her about Leo's offer. But when she asked if he got DiCaprio's digit, he didn't, and she was disappointed. She was beside herself. She chalked it up to Pete not fully grasping the significance of Leo's offer. What's the significance? He's just a big celebrity.
I know. It's like if Jack Nicholson offers you tips. Not really. No, yeah. Thanks. On speaking. If you want to act, yeah. But
great.
I know that's a lot of confidence that he has. You know, he's like tiptoeing around politics. Right. You never know if he's going to get in. Next. The superhero costume worn by George Clooney in 1997's Batman and Robin is up for auction. It comes with a hyper-realistic Clooney mannequin. Wow, hyper-realistic. Heritage Auction says the Batsuit, made famous by the Joel Schumacher film and infamous for the exaggerated nipples, featured on the body armor. There were exaggerated nipples on his body armor?
You learn a new thing every day.
Did you know this?
I did not know about exaggerated nipples.
I mean, I got to start hanging with Hollywood types.
If only Leonardo wanted to give you advice.
Right. It would be great. Then I'd ask him about George Clooney's nipples on his Batman outfit. It would be perfect. The call and cape are both marked GC for George Clooney and originally came with the Warner Brothers archives. The bodysuit is a stunt suit, and the bat emblem from cape fasteners were created from originals to complete the display. I don't know how much people would pay, but I don't think he was happy with the performance. Is that true? He was not happy. I don't think he liked his Batman performance.
I don't know that answer. Pete would know, but unfortunately, you're stuck talking to me today.
Next. COVID was the third leading cause of death in the U.S. in 2020 and 2021. 1 in 8 people lost their lives. Oh, that ended up dying. Heart disease remained number one. Cancer, number two. COVID, number three. Accidental deaths, that's a pretty broad one. And stroke, 267,000. Why that matters, the virus expected a huge human toll after vaccines became available and directly affected other causes of death. Perhaps.
Because people are afraid to go to the doctor to get their regular checkups.
Yeah. Next. Americans trust local and family-owned businesses more than any other kind. They polled 2,000 people. 67% said, give me the local hardware store over Home Depot. Does that surprise you?
It makes total sense. They're generally people in your community. You know them. You know, they don't want to lie to you and then bump into you later at like a T-ball game.
Right. That's could be true. Flexible flyer. You got to buy a flexible flyer. You're not going to get it at Home Depot. You go to the local hardware store.
And the local hardware stores, I will say, generally give the kids a nice little toy of some sort.
Really?
They usually do to Richard.
Hardware stores have toys?
They give. He always comes home with something when he goes with Andy, whether it's a lollipop or some little fun thing that he's thrilled about.
All right. That's good to know. Next. Dog became man's best friend thanks to a gene that lowers stress, according to our new research. One of the world's most famous pets descends from wolves. However, the domestication of the dog has baffled evolutionary experts for decades. A Japanese team believes they have solved the riddle. Dogs carry two mutations of a gene known as MC2R. Jot this down, please, because it's called melanocortin 2 receptor. It produces the hormone cortisol, nature's built-in alarm system, which releases when someone experiences fear or anxiety. Does that make sense now?
I'll look it up more, but did you see, too, though, that Brazil is the home to the happiest dog owners? Is that a random fact for you?
Right. Something I really can't make any use of. Although no. Tucker was in Brazil 2 weeks ago. I could have given that to Tucker.
You couldn't. You could have asked people on the street if they're the happiest dog owners.
Next. The average customer spends $314 each month on impulse buys. Currently, the average spends $314 a month, up from $276 in 2021 and $183 in 2020. 3 in 4, that's 73% of respondents, say most of their purchases tend to be spontaneous. A large number from 59% who held the same sentiment last year. Why do you think that is?
I'm not sure, but my question for you is, do you think that's an accurate number, 314 a month, or do you spend more on impulse buys?
I don't know. What's an impulse buy? A buy that you never buy and know it's an impulse buy. You identify impulse buys if you don't use it in the aftermath of your end-of-the-year inventory.
I would say impulse buy is like you're in line at the store and you see something really fun. You're like, why not? You just grab it because it looks cool.
And you mean an impulse buy, but an impulse buy tends to mean it's an accessory not needed.
Or just something you didn't really think much about, or like you just like thought it was cool in the moment and you just grabbed it without doing a lot of research on it.
That's a good point. I think that you could do that, but a lot of times they put these things on the closer as you weave through the line to get your attention to alert you to things you might need.
Correct. That you never knew you needed. Does that make sense? No.
Yes.
But yeah. But you also tend to buy a lot of things because you just forget them, like chargers, right?
Right. But now I have two chargers here, ready to go on my iPad, ready to go on my iPhone.
Let's see if they're going to be there tomorrow.
I hope so. Well, we know who to blame.
You?
Yes.
No.
All right. Thanks so much for listening. Keep it here. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Put the power of over 100 meteorologists and the worldwide resources of Fox in your hands with the Fox Weather Podcast. Precise, personal, powerful. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.